Did you know that 6 of the 9 agencies involved in the refugee resettlement programs have religious affiliations? If you're like most Americans, the details of how these programs work, who's involved, and how they get their funding aren't well known. Hello, I'm your host, Sam Rohr, and today we're going to be talking about this issue with our guest, Leo Homan, editor of WorldNet Daily and author of the book, Stealth Invasion, Muslim Conquest Through Immigration and Resettlement.
Welcome to Stand in the Gap Weekend, the American Pastors Network Week in Review, featuring the best segments taken from our Stand in the Gap Today daily program. Our goal is to equip the pastor, church leader, and all believers to think critically and biblically in a culture that increasingly rejects truth. Stand by to hear a focused analysis of current events viewed through the lens of a biblical and constitutional worldview. The pastor's and the believer's goal should be to impact our culture for Christ. As part of our mission to urge pastors to boldly preach the whole counsel of God and equip people to be soldiers and ambassadors for Christ, we're establishing APN chapters in all 50 states. Learn more on the web at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. That's AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. Now, here's our host and American Pastors Network President, Sam Rohr.
Welcome to Stand in the Gap Weekend. We're glad that you've joined us today as we analyze the most pressing issues affecting our culture from a biblical and constitutional perspective. Historically, the church has always had at its heart a compassion for those who are not only lost and in need of salvation, but for those who are also suffering because of the fallen state of this world. Famine, disease, natural disasters, and war are only a part of the miseries the human race has endured. Under the operation of humanitarian agencies, the church has done a great amount of good to alleviate these woes. But what happens when these religious organizations, funded by the government, are influenced from their original mission and in fact become complicit with sinister strategies? Now, as we head into today's program, you may hear some information of which you weren't aware, and facts that seem just too impossible to be true. Yet we hope that what we share today will give you a greater understanding of what's happening behind the scenes, what the media's not telling you, or what half-truths are being told, and what can make the difference between a slow, silent erosion of our nation or a quickening to bring what's in the shadows out into the light so that it can be corrected. In this first selection, taken from our broadcast on February the 20th, which was President's Day last week, we introduce our guest, Leo Homan, editor of WorldNet Daily and author of the book, Stealth Invasion, Muslim Conquest Through Immigration and Resettlement. Along with myself and Dr. Gary Dahl, we will begin our discussion with a brief commentary on the common thread that runs through the focus of the left on 3 issues: Obamacare, Muslim refugee resettlement programs in the United States, and open borders. Then in the following segments, we'll discuss the resettlement programs in greater detail.
Well, today is President's Day. Banks are closed. Congress is at home. So far, so good, right? But what will members of Congress face when they hold their town meetings in their districts? That may not be so good. And we're going to discuss what Obama-linked activists have in store for congressional town hall meetings as they are lining up to protest President Trump and his immigration policies and intimidate primarily Republican members as they speak in their districts. Now, in addition, we're going to focus on the matter of immigrants today, and specifically the issue of what's called refugee resettlement, a multi-billion dollar Barack Obama boondoggle. And we're going to discuss the purpose of the refugee settlement, the cost of it, the participants in this costly and controversial program. And to help us in these discussions, we're going to welcome our special guest, Leo Homan. He's an investigative reporter and news editor for WorldNet Daily, and he's the current managing editor of Triangle Business Journal in Raleigh, North Carolina. He's also the author of Stealth Invasion, Muslim Conquest Through Immigration and Resettlement Jihad. And with that, I'm going to welcome you to today's program. I'm Sam Rohr, joined today by Gary Dahl and Isaac Crockett, a previous guest on our Stand in the Gap Today program, and of course our special guest, Leo Homan. Well, Gary, Isaac and Leah, we have a lot to cover today on this program, and with God's help, we're going to bring some clarity to this issue of immigration. On Friday of last week, ladies and gentlemen, with our guest IQ Al-Rasuli, we discussed in a cursory fashion an article by Paul Sperry in the New York Post entitled, How Obama is Scheming to Sabotage Trump's Presidency. And because of President's Day and Congress being back home in their districts this week, Barack Obama's plan to sabotage the Trump administration will see an extended strategy, I think, as we're going to see it take place. We're going to talk about that and what a prior president, Barack Obama, is actually doing here beginning on President's Day and then going forth. Now, a second article by Paul Sperry, again, investigative reporter for the New York Post, which appeared over the weekend, has this title, quote, Obama-linked activists have a training manual for protesting Trump. And let me read from that, men, just a little bit as I set this up here for today, and then I'm going to go to Gary here for the first question. But from this article, it starts out by saying this, an Obama-tied activist group training tens of thousands of agitators to protest President Trump's policies planned to hit Republican lawmakers supporting these policies even harder this week when they return home for the congressional recess and hold town hall meetings and other functions. Organizing for Action, OFA, a group founded by Obama and featured prominently on his new post-presidency website, is distributing a training manual to anti-Trump activists that advises them to bully GOP lawmakers into backing off support for repealing Obamacare, curbing immigration from high-risk Islamic nations, and building a border wall. I'm going to stop right there, but this is a very, very sinister group led by the president. Gary, let me go to you first here, because we did comment a little bit about it last time. This article and the others states the fact that there are over 250 offices associated with OFA, Organizing for Action, overseen by the former president, over 32,000 engaged activists. There are training sessions that are being planned, have already happened as well, with stated purposes that include disrupt, mobilize, intimidate, and with goals that include bringing down the Trump administration. Gary, just in a simple terms, does this sound to you like normal free speech, First Amendment issues?
No. Actually, to me, Sam, it sounds like anarchy, rebellion, divisiveness, immaturity, hatred, and an irresponsible action from a former president. Does that get to the point?
I was going to say, can you add anything to that, Gary? You know, because in reality, I don't know how else you can comment on that.
No.
Hey, yo, no. Let me go to you on this now, if you can, because, Leo, you've done a lot of writing on this, and Gary just summed up. I mean, it made a little bit of a humorous thing there, but in reality, this is serious business when a former president is actually extensively engaged with efforts to change the landscape of America and now doing these things which are that are happening as a result of Organizing for Action. In addition, Leo, I'm going to ask you this, but this is another piece from this article from what they're saying. Quote, they are distributing a training manual to anti-Trump activists, advising them, again, to bully lawmakers into these issues, as I just said, curbing immigration, repealing Obamacare, and building a border wall. That's what they're trying to oppose. Leo, what is the common thread that includes keeping Obamacare, keeping open the conduits to high-risk Islamic Nation immigrants, and keeping open a border? Why are these the main issues that these individuals, that Gary said is an anarchist, and I say they are too, why are they focusing so much on keeping these things open and in place?
Well, you know, well, first of all, Gary, just one quick correction. I mean, Sam, one quick correction. At the outset of the show, you said I was the current managing editor of Triangle Business Journal. That was actually back in the 1990s, so I just wanted to set that straight. I didn't want somebody to hear that and then accuse me of putting out a false resume. Mm. Okay, so I'm currently news editor at WorldNet Daily. But yeah, that is a very good question, Sam. And, you know, there's several common threads. And I think, first of all, you know, what we're looking at is the whole idea, the Marxist idea of collectivism. The border, open borders policy invites the world in. We see that most of the people coming in are coming from either socialist or Islamic countries, which, as you know, have a high degree of statism, where the state controls everybody's life from day to day. And so those people come here with similar socialistic ideas and expect our government here to be a nanny state and to take care of their every need. You know, and the same thing goes for Obamacare. That's just another ripple effect of this type of mentality, whether it be the Islamic totalitarian system or the social communist totalitarian system. That's the common thread there is collectivism, where we are responsible, the government is responsible for making that sure that everyone is taken care of from cradle to grave. And so the third thing that I would say shares commonality is open borders, unfettered Islamic immigration. We are looking more and more, as Gary said, at a prospect ahead of us with anarchy. And I really feel that as these people get out and do their protests and become more and more hysterical and provoke more and more people to respond to them, I really feel like they're hoping.
I'm going to stop you right there, Leo, because we're up against a hard break. Just continue your thought. When we come back after this break,
sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back with more right after these messages.
We've just heard the first portion of our broadcast on the topic of refugee resettlement programs, where our guest, Leo Homan of WorldNet Daily, identified the Marxist idea of collectivism as the common thread that runs between the leftist preoccupation with Obamacare, refugee resettlement programs, and open borders. This is the idea that the state or the government can and should control the lives of its citizens. We're going to move now to some specifics about the refugee resettlement programs. How did they begin? How many refugees are being brought into our country? And where are they being resettled?
In this segment, we're going to move now specifically into the matter of refugee resettlement. And to help Isaac and Gary and I do that, we're going to now welcome again officially Leo Homan. And as he said, he is the news editor of WorldNet Daily, has written a book on stealth invasion, Muslim conquest through immigration and resettlement jihad, and a leading authority on this matter of refugee settlement. And with that, let me go ahead and set this up here for us for this segment. At the heart of Barack Obama's wide open immigration policies, which have focused primarily, we say that primarily because really it has, the numbers indicate it, primarily on Islamic refugees. This entire program has been referred to as refugee resettlement. And by and large, and I want Leo to ask you this, but I believe it also clearly ties in with this whole issue of sanctuary cities that you have written a lot about. And there are also billions of dollars, borrowed dollars, I say, by the way, because this debt has gone up under this last president enormously, but borrowed dollars to actually grease the skids of the resettlement program. So, Leo, let me start specifically with this question to you. You've written exclusively on the topic of refugee resettlement, or not particularly and only, but you certainly have built this out. Give us, in your opinion, a quick history of when this refugee resettlement program began and who started it. Was it Barack Obama? Did it begin beforehand? Or if it began beforehand, what did Barack Obama do to change it?
Oh, my goodness, yes, it began well before Barack Obama. The problem is that nobody'd ever heard of it until Barack Obama started, upping the ante. This program has been going on in its current form since the late 70s, early 80s. We've always taken in refugees, but after the Refugee Act of 1980 was passed, it was after that that we started putting our refugee program under the auspices of the United Nations and letting the United Nations pick more and more of our refugees until now it is like 95% of the refugees coming here from overseas have been hand-selected by the United Nations UNCHR High Commissioner for Refugees. And the current Secretary General of the UN, Mr. Antonio Guterres, who is a leading socialist from the Socialist Party in Portugal, he actually headed up the Socialist International for several years, and in 2005 he became head of the UNCHR High Commissioner for Refugees. And so now he's been, after serving in that post for over a decade, he's been promoted to Secretary General just this at the beginning of this year, mm-hmm. in January. And so, the program initially started with us taking, you know, a lot of refugees from communist Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, then later Russia, Cuba. You know, we were rescuing people from communist dictatorships, but it morphed more and more into a program that was an Islamic population shift in overdrive. And it's to the point now where half of the refugees we take in, just under half of all the refugees we take from around the world every year, are Muslim. And so that's about 40... Let's see, we took in 85,000 last year, and about 40,000 of them were Muslim. So you can see how that is, and that was a record number, by the way, last year under Barack Obama. But this trend has been continuing, has started really since the days of Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan especially started taking in more Muslim refugees from the country of Afghanistan. He called them freedom fighters because they were fighting the Soviets. And then President Bush, the first Bush, took in some from Iraq after the first Iraq war. And it's just like every president since then has taken in a larger share, to the point where under President Obama we took in 40,000. And that's just from the refugee program. Muslims come to the U.S. under other programs as well. That is sort of the history. We are taking in a total of about 130,000 per year on all immigration programs, green card, and those are mostly green card permanent residents coming from Muslim countries, 130,000 per year. At least that many more come every year on temporary visas, student visas, work visas, and fiancé visas, entrepreneurial visas. Oh, and then there's something called the religious visa, where we're actually bringing in hardcore militant Sharia imams from the Middle East under the religious visa program.
Wow, Leo, this is just frightening to hear all of this, and I think it's so important for all of our listeners to understand what is happening. But as important as it is to understand what they're doing, I guess the question in our minds, or at least my mind, is why? I mean, why are they doing this? Why has this major effort been put into place to bring in these large numbers of Muslims from dangerous countries?
Well, you have to look at it in perspective. The United States is a large country. It's a country of immigrants. We've been called the melting pot by other countries. You have countries like Sweden that are much smaller and have gone on a similar immigration, multicultural diversity binge, but it's affecting them much faster. Sweden is a country of 10 million people, and so if they bring in a million Muslims over a period of 20 years, you know, that's going to have an astounding, fast, and noticeable impact right away. And we're seeing that now in Sweden. Over the last few years, it's become the rape capital of Europe, which it had been one of the most peaceful countries in the world. Now they have gang violence and out-of-control rape. Now, in America, it's going to be much slower because we're a country of 350 million people, and we have 3.5 1.3 million Muslims. Now, you may say that's a lot of Muslims, and it is compared to 20 years ago when we had, you know, maybe a million. In a country of 350 million, that is still a relatively very small percentage. You know, you're talking 1% of our population, whereas in Sweden it's, you know, approaching 10%. So it is going to be gradual, and it is going to take a while for this country to be completely Islamized. But under Barack Obama, the Muslim community achieved much more influence than its numbers would indicate that it should have. He invited the Muslim Brotherhood right into the federal government to advise him in posts at the Homeland Security Department, Department of Justice, and various immigration agencies. And so they accumulated a lot of political capital and influence during that time.
You know, Leo, and I appreciate you mentioning that, because we've emphasized that a lot here in the program, the Muslim Brotherhood, and how it has been allowed to infiltrate into positions, high positions in Washington, D.C. But, you know, in addition to those 40,000 Muslims who are being brought in through the refugee program, I understand that there are also something like 260,000 Muslims per year entering into the United States of America, you know, in addition to those 40,000. Is that correct?
That is the total grand combined total, 260,000.
Of Muslims.
Yeah.
Of Muslim.
So that includes refugees and all the others, and it includes permanent and temporary. Permanent is about 130,000 per year. The other half are coming in, as we said, as students, as preachers, as entrepreneurs. You know, the local convenience store down the street from you is probably owned by an Indian or a Pakistani, and there's a good chance he could be Muslim.
They're here on an
entrepreneurial visa.
Sure.
The imam at your local mosque is here on a religious visa, and so the list goes on. Yeah.
Well, I know a Muslim who's come to Christ a number of years ago. He said that his family actually came into this country. Of course, he eventually came to Christ, but he said that he actually came into this country as a mosque planter, as it were. You know, as Christians, we talk about church planters.
Mm-hmm.
But they actually came in to establish mosques throughout the United States of America. So of those other 200,000 plus beyond the refugees who are Muslims coming into this nation, we have no idea the impact that they are having here upon our country. And the question that I have to you, really, is where are most of these people being resettled throughout this nation of ours?
That's a good question. You know, they're not just being resettled as originally was happening in major gateway cities like New York, Chicago, Miami, L.A. No, these people in recent years are increasingly likely to be coming to small-town America. I would say over the last 10 years or so, they have been increasingly coming to places like Owatonna, Minnesota. You know, I couldn't place that on a map, could you? No.
No.
And Rutland, Vermont, and, you know, Owensboro, Kentucky, and just sort of middle America places like that, Fort Collins, you know, Colorado. And what we find that a lot of these smaller cities and towns that are getting these refugees have in common is that they have meatpacking plants nearby.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's an important point, and we've experienced that right here in the Altoona, Pennsylvania, where I live. I just wanted to bring that up. Sam?
All right. Thank you, Gary. And ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Stand in the Gap today with this Sam Rohr, Gary Dahl, and Isaac Crockett today, and our special guest, Leo Holman. When we come back from this break, we're going to continue on the theme of refugee resettlement. But we're going to look specifically at who is involved. When Barack Obama's brought him in, he didn't do it himself. What are the organizations that help? We'll be interested and surprised.
We're glad you're listening to today's Stand in the Gap Weekend. Did you know that the American Pastors Network produces not only Stand in the Gap Today and Stand in the Gap Weekend, but also a one-minute program carried on over 200 stations nationwide called Stand in the Gap Minute? Here's the program from last week. I hope that you enjoy this important challenge. A worldview is the lens through which a person views the world. A biblical worldview is viewing God and life through a faithfully interpreted biblical lens. Unfortunately, few people, including less than 50% of pastors, hold a biblical worldview. I submit that this is why truth and common sense are in such short supply in our nation. Hello, I'm Sam Rohr with the American Pastors Network and another Stand in the Gap Bennett. At APN, we encourage pastors to prepare their sermons and equip their congregations and families to view and live life with a genuine biblical worldview, a view that should impact all areas from family to education, government to the arts, and from science to spending. After all, if Christians think and act like the world, why would anyone around us want what we have? For the next four programs, I'll explain the elements of a true biblical worldview. The American Pastors Network, pastors preaching the truth, equipping saints for service. Visit us at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net to find out how you can help. Welcome back to Stand in the Gap Weekend. If you've just joined us, we've been listening to a replay of our daily program, originally airing on February the 20th. As always, if you're interested in hearing past programs or would like to listen to our daily program online every day, you can do so by going to our website at standinthegapradio.com. It's heard from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can listen to it there right on our website, standinthegapradio.com. You can access our archives or find resources to help you understand many of the issues confronting our nation with an application from a biblical worldview. Now, in this next segment, we're going to refocus on the groups involved in the refugee resettlement programs. We're going to identify them and discuss how they're financed and why there may be a conflict of interest when they protest President Trump's travel ban blocking the flow of refugees and consequently the flow of financial aid.
We're going to continue now with the discussion on refugee resettlement. And before I get going here on this section, Leo, and ask you the specific questions of who's involved, you made a comment in the last segment that I just want to find out if there's anything interesting about it here. And that is that you said if you have a meatpacking place close to, it's probably being a lot of the employees are probably Muslims. And then Gary texted me during the break and actually suggested that there's a lot of meatpacking places around him, and he finds that to be true. Is there anything significant about that, or is that just a coincidence?
It's no coincidence, and I'm not suggesting that all the employees at a meatpacking plant are going to be Muslim, but I am suggesting that they will be present, especially if it is owned by an international conglomerate. You know, a lot of the meatpacking facilities in our country, like so many other industries, have been internationalized over the last 20 years. And with that internationalization, that globalization brings foreign workers in more likely to be employed. It seems like that's what I found in my research. And it's not only meatpacking plants. Food processing plants in general should be looked at. Chobani Yogurt, for instance, operates the world's largest yogurt plant in Twin Falls, Idaho. Lo and behold, 30% of their workforce at that plant are refugees. And so what happened, what we found out is that this started under the Clinton presidency. Bill Clinton had some friends in the meatpacking industry, and he brought some refugees over from Eastern Europe, and they ended up being employed in the meatpacking plants. This grew under President George W. Bush. As you might recall, President George W. Bush actually conducted some raids on meatpacking plants and arrested a good many illegal immigrant workers at these plants. They were from Latin America, like most of our illegals are. And so in response to that, the meatpacking industry, which had already become addicted to cheap foreign labor, making use of these illegals coming in from Mexico and Central America, they needed a quick fix to replace some of these illegals that were suddenly being arrested at their plants under George W. Bush. And so what they did is they went full force into the recruitment of refugee labor. And this is completely legal, as opposed to the illegals coming across the border from Latin America. The refugees coming in are here at the invitation of the U.S. government. So they were able to change out their Latin American illegal workforce with a Middle Eastern, more Middle Eastern-looking and North African, so to speak-looking refugee workforce that was completely legal.
Interesting. Well, that brings us right into the next question I wanted to go to next, is that this has been happening, as you said, under a couple of administrations, clearly sped up under the Barack Obama administration, but they can't do this on their own. And I want to walk now into this issue of who is helping them. Lots of money. I've seen numbers in the billions of dollars. You have too. You may have more up-to-date numbers even what I've looked at. But who is and how is the process used? In other words, what entities out there, organizations, have actually risen to this challenge and are the ones that are being utilized most by the Barack Obama administration, particularly in the placement of these refugees across the country? I think it may be surprising, but name a couple of them if you could.
Well, it's the same agencies that have been used by President George W. Bush and President Clinton and President George Herbert Walker Bush and President Reagan, for the most part. There are 9 resettlement agencies in this country, and they have a nice, tidy little agreement, a contract with the government that makes them a lot of money every year, in which they resettle the refugees. They do the government's work for the government for a price, and they are actually paid per head for every refugee that they bring into this country. And 6 of the 9 resettlement agencies, also called VOLAGs, volunteer agencies, 6 of the 9 have religious affiliations. They're affiliated with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which works through Catholic Charities and other groups. You have Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, which works through Lutheran Social Services and other myriad Lutheran groups. You have World Relief, which is an arm of the National Association of Evangelicals. You have Episcopal Migration Ministries, and you have the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, just to name a few. And so there are 3 others that are secular in nature, such as the International Rescue Committee. But these 9 groups have exclusive contracts with the government. It's called a public-private partnership, or PPP, in which we've heard a lot about those in other areas of our economy, but not so much in refugee resettlement.
Leo, I'm just wondering, and I'm glad that you brought this up, as to some of the organizations that are working with bringing these refugees in and so forth. But can you provide some information on how much money has actually been spent on this over the years? And in addition to that, how much money has been laundered through some of these primary conduits for refugee resettlement, such as the Catholic Charities and World Relief and World Vision and so forth?
Yeah, that's a good question, Gary. Let's just take a look at U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which operates through Catholic Charities primarily. If you look at their Form 990 for 2014, which is the most recent data we can find, they brought in a total of $85 million. That was their total revenue. $79 million of that, 97%, came from government grants. And so that tells you that even though they refer to themselves as Catholic Charities, they're really not a charity at all, because as you and I would think of a charity, we would think of a religious organization passing the hat around the church and sort of gathering up donations from its members. At least that's how I think of a charity, that it operates through donations. But this charity operates through government grants. And there's numerous ways they can bring in federal money, not only by... But basically, the more refugees they bring in, the more revenue they collect from the government.
Isaac, Isaac, I'm sure, has a question, but I want to follow up on that, if I may. In light of the fact of what you've explained, number one, are they breaking the IRS code when they do that? And then secondly, could this be traced back to the faith-based initiatives that were started in the early 90s under George W. Bush to any degree?
That is a good question, and I'm not a tax accountant, so I will pass on the first question. I do believe these agencies predated George W. Bush, so I don't know that we could rack it up to his particular faith-based initiative, but faith-based initiatives were not all that new. You know, he just popularized the term and expanded it into other areas. But these six of the nine have a long history of working with the government that predates George W. Bush.
All right,
Isaac.
Yeah,
got a question
on that. Then, Leo. As we look at this, if 90% of their budget is really coming from the government, leading up to this, the Obama administration pushing these people in, are these really Christian principles that are governing these organizations, or is it more sinister, more like the Obama administration that's bringing the refugees in?
I believe that when these agencies started out, they probably did have a very strong Christian motivation for what they do, and they still couch their programs in religious terms. They quote a lot of Bible verses to justify what they're doing, treating the stranger with love and reaching out to the stranger in the country and welcoming the stranger. You will just see that repeated ad nauseum in a lot of their outreach. But over the years, as they have expanded, like so many, let's face it, Christian organizations, I can think of Christian universities that started out on fire for God and over the years became more distant from their original mission. And I think it's the same with these organizations, including World Relief, which used to be a wonderful organization that focused on evangelizing and missionary work. But that's the other part of this program that is sinister and proves to me that it is sinister and not all lollipops and balloons like they say. They agree, as part of this contract that we spoke of earlier with the government, they agree not to proselytize or evangelize the refugees. And so here you have them reaching out with one hand to accept government money and with the other hand pulling back what they used to do as far as outreach and missionary zeal refugees.
Wow, Leo, I'm going to pick up a little bit on the other side when we come back after that break, because it's almost the principle is if you begin taking government money, is it going to deter you in the mission? You made that statement, and I think we've seen it happen a lot. In addition to this, I want to ask you about it when you come back. Some of these organizations, like World Relief, has also taken monies from George Soros Foundation, which is absolutely sinister. So we want to look at that when we come back and then conclude with the theme of what we can do here to address this issue going forward. How can we wake up the American people?
At the American Pastors Network, we urge pastors and Christian parents to seek a Christian education for their children, not as a preference, but a conviction. Whether in homeschool or Christian school, a Christian education is essential if we ever hope to raise godly children and change the culture for Christ. That's why on this program and our Stand in the Gap Today program, we are glad to partner with BJU Press, the nation's largest provider of K-12 Christian curriculum, academically excellent, biblically sound, and historically accurate. Hello, this is Sam Rohr. Although the term Christian education doesn't occur in the Bible, it does speak of the moral and spiritual instruction of children. It places a high value on knowledge, both of God and His works. It describes the moral and spiritual fruits of this knowledge and defines its ultimate purpose, the growth of your child in godliness of character and action. That's why we suggest you consider BJU Press K-12 materials. Your child's a unique individual created for a specific purpose. Proper instruction that includes the Bible and the relational influence of godly teachers produces a pure heart and a willing mind. The Bible calls that success. BJU Press materials are well written, grade level appropriate, and biblically integrated. They teach critical thinking skills and keep your child engaged and excited about learning. If you're a Christian school teacher or administrator, a homeschool teacher, or a parent who just wants your child to learn more, start by exploring the BJU Press website. Visit bjupress.com. That's bjupress.com. Well, friends, as we move into the final part of our program today, we're going to continue on our topic of refugee resettlement programs. Our guest, Leo Homan, with WorldNet Daily, an online news service, continues to share his research on the organizations involved and why things may not be what they seem. We're also going to talk about the result of the increasing agitation from both the left and the right over this issue and what can be done about it. Now, if you're a pastor and wanting to know more about this subject, please visit our website at standinthegapradio.com. And if you are a Christian and are motivated by this program, please pass along this topic and our website to your pastor. I believe he will appreciate your interest. On this site, we've posted videos, articles, and radio programs addressing the immigration issue from a biblical and constitutional perspective. Again, please feel free to share them with a friend, your congregation, or your pastor.
As we conclude the program today in this final segment on refugee resettlement, we've talked about a number of things. Where it got started, it actually predated Barack Obama. He definitely has upped the ante in this. He spent a lot of money. We've talked about where these refugees are coming from and the numbers of them. We also, in the last segment, then, Leo Homan, you identified the names of certain organizations like Catholic Charities, World Relief, certain Lutheran organizations, but effectively six of nine you cited were religious-based entities who've lined up to take federal money. And as you've said, by so doing, they actually have agreed not to proselytize, which means not share the gospel with the people who come in, which is an extraordinarily ironic thing. I want you to confirm what you said in that regard. What I'm asking you is this: is the receipt of the money by these organizations, by the contract, by the granting, the grant monies that come under the PPP arrangement, do they have as a part of it a condition that upon receipt of the monies, they in fact do not proselytize, therefore share the gospel with these refugees when they come in? Is that what you're saying?
100%. Yes, I've got it documented in my book, my new book, Stealth Invasion. I've got the actual web page from the U.S. State Department, which describes this agreement, documented in the footnotes. And they 100% must agree to this clause, not to proselytize or evangelize, share the gospel, whatever you want to call it, with the refugees that they serve.
Leo, that is an astounding statement, because just recently, World Relief, as an example, sent a letter to the president and the vice president, open letter in the Washington Post, condemning the president for his limitation on immigration policies. And they started out that letter by saying, we as pastors and church leaders, in the fulfillment of our mission to reach out and help the poor and the refugee, do embark effectively on this, and they chastise the president for limiting that. But you are stating that in the execution of their mission, they have already compromised and agreed not to share the gospel with the very people they say they are intending to help. That is an astounding thing.
That's why it's so deceptive. If you read that letter, that open letter, if it's the one I'm thinking of that you're referring to, the 100 evangelical leaders signed, you'll see nowhere in the text of that letter anything about spreading the gospel to the people that they serve. It's all about feeding and clothing and loving, which is an important part, but it is not to be the only part of our outreach to the non-Christian world. If you read what they're doing is they're playing on emotions of God-fearing, well-meaning Americans without telling the whole truth. They're telling half the truth. Yes, we help feed and clothe these people. And you could argue they don't even do a great job of that, but that's a whole other topic. But we're not, they're not telling the other side of the story that a Christian would want to know. That is, are you sharing the gospel with these people?
Hmm. Gary, I'm sure you've got a question you want to follow up on that before I want to go to Isaac at the end here. I want to ask him, as a millennial pastor, what he would say to those who were listening from a millennial perspective on this regard. Gary, because my an overall question is, you know, really, is the president going to be successful at what he's doing?
Well, you know, I think he's going to be working hard on that. And my question is that with over 32,000 mostly professional activists aligned with OFA, that is the Organizing for Action, 25,000 more being trained in March and then being led by Barack Obama from his D.C. bunker, as it were, just a couple of miles from the White House. We're going to, you know, are we going to be able to avoid physical conflict on the streets of America? Leo, I've said all along, and Sam will confirm this, I think that we may be heading for a civil war, and that really concerns me. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I unfortunately think that you're spot on the target there, Gary. It's very sad, because what I think we are going to see happening is that we are going to be increasingly polarized and divided. Conservatives are going to see the hysteria from these left-wing people, and they're going to and the media taking their side and making it look like everyone in America is against Donald Trump, knowing that, hey, I'm for Donald Trump, my neighbor's for Donald Trump, my family's for Donald Trump, his policies. You know, so why is the media making it look like everybody's against him? And then you may see them get out in the streets. Or we could also see some of this, the left wing, I believe our side will be peaceful if we get out in the streets, but there's always provocateurs out there. And I believe there could be a provocation of either violence on behalf of police, where police get provoked into cracking down a little harder than they may need to, and then that would be used to cast Donald Trump. Oh, see, he is a fascist dictator. He is trying to bring us into a fascist system, you know, when it was all provoked by their people to begin with. Or you could see, you know, a provocation with our side out on the streets. I'm very worried about this, indeed.
Leo, in just 30 seconds here, if you could, at this point, where does the greatest hope lie? Obviously, we know the message of Jesus Christ and the gospel is what changes hearts, and that ultimately is what is needed. But from the standpoint of a human perspective, where is the greatest hope for an awakening to occur in America relative to these things? Is it? I mean, it's obviously not out of government. Where do you think it's from?
No, I really do believe that the greatest hope lies with our pastors, and that they would wake up and start teaching their
Amen.
Flock, teaching their flocks about Islam, and how the revived, reawakened Islam is not just something over there to be worried about in the occasional terrorist attack over here. It is a dynamic culture change that we're about to witness before our eyes, and our children and grandchildren will see the fruits of it if we don't stand up and be counted as Bible-believing Christians and be out there as Christians, just as the Muslims are out there as part of the Islamic faith. We can't hide our light any longer. It's too late for that. We really must stand up. We must take our faith seriously. This is what happened to Europe. Europe became a post-Christian society after World War II, and that's what opens the door to Islam. They will rush into the vacuum.
Leo, I want to conclude the program by having Isaac praying for us. But ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Stand in the Gap today, and this is Leo Homan. I want you to go to WorldNet Daily. You can seek out his articles there. Search on his name, Leo Homan, H-O-H-M-A-N-N. Leo, thank you for being with us. We want to close the program in prayer today. Isaac, I'd like to have you do that for us as a millennial pastor. You and the younger generation are really key to all of this. Take us to the Lord in prayer as we close the program today.
Father, we thank you so much for your goodness to us, for your grace, for your love to us in Jesus Christ. We thank you that he is the way, the truth, and the life. And I pray that you would make us bold witnesses of that, whether in Africa or in America, and that we would share that truth with all peoples and share your love through what you have given us in the Word of God. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to Stand in the Gap Weekend, a ministry production of the American Pastors Network. If you like what you've heard, you can listen to our daily program online by visiting our website at standinthegapradio.com. You can listen live daily to Stand in the Gap Today from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Time right there, or you can look for a station in your area on our station listings page. You can also listen to our short program called Stand in the Gap Minute, which you heard earlier in the program. This short commentary is a daily reflection on spiritual truths designed to help you in your walk with God. All three programs, Stand in the Gap Minute, Stand in the Gap Today, and Stand in the Gap Weekend, can be found at standinthegapradio.com. Just click on the name of the program that you're interested in to access the archives. Stand in the Gap Radio is a ministry production of the American Pastors Network. Maybe this is the first time that you've heard about the American Pastors Network and you're wondering what we're all about, but you like the practical nature and the boldness of our programs. Well, our mission is to identify and encourage pastors who believe in the authority of Scripture to stand in the gap for truth more boldly. Our radio programs are designed to encourage and equip the people of God to know God's Word, to understand and apply a biblical worldview to the issues of the day, and to be bold ambassadors for Christ in a most critical time in our nation's history. Now, can I talk with you personally today? Tens of thousands of wonderful people like you are listening to this program right now and are being blessed by this program. I rejoice as I travel the country to find people nearly everywhere who will come up and share with me how this program and our other radio programs or our weekly emails and other resources are blessing their lives. But it's possible that you've never written or contacted us, so would you let us know that you are being blessed by this program? Could I ask you or encourage you to contact us this week? Would you take just a minute and write to us or send us an email to let us know that you're listening? If you contact us and you give us your email address, we'll send to you as a free gift, just for letting us know that you're listening, the Patriot's Essential Pocket Guide containing a copy of the documents that outline our freedoms as written by our founding fathers. To contact us, please send your card or letter to American Pastors Network, 83 West Main Street, Suite 3, Elverson, Pennsylvania, 19520. That's American Pastors Network, 83 West Main Street, Suite 3, Elverson, Pennsylvania, 19520. If you wish to donate, you can call us. You can do so at 610-901-3607, or you can go to our website at standinthegapradio.com and press the donate button. You can also visit us on Facebook at American Pastors Network or on Twitter at American Pastors. Would you give us a visit this week? We'd love to hear from you. So very, very important. You know, America is a crossroads. God's people hold the key, but the pulpits of America must lead the way. Help us at the American Pastors Network to stand in the gap for truth now. We hope to hear from you this week. Until next time, stand in the gap for truth wherever you are.
Thank you for listening to Stand in the Gap Weekend, the American Pastors Network Week in Review. Our goal is to equip the pastor, church leader, and all believers to think critically and biblically in a culture that increasingly rejects truth, and to provide you with a focused analysis of current events viewed through the lens of a biblical and constitutional worldview. APN promotes the return of our nation to God through preaching, praying, and equipping Christians to reclaim the culture as soldiers and ambassadors of Christ. God hears the calls of His people who learn the truth and obey it. To partner with APN, please visit us on the web at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. That's AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. You can sign up to receive regular updates, to become a prayer partner, or to help as a financial partner. You may also call us at 610-901-3607. Again, that's 610-901-3607. To listen to any of our Stand in the Gap programs, including our live daily program, go to standinthegapradio.com. That's standinthegapradio.com. Thank you for listening today, and be sure to tune in next week at this same time for Stand in the Gap Weekend, the American Pastors Network. Pastors preaching the truth, equipping their people to impact the culture for Christ.